Today on Maine Calling, witches, then and now. Chances are a little witch may come to your door tonight, trick-or-treating with a ghost, fairy, or maybe a pirate. And witches never go out of style as Halloween decorations, like that witch on a broomstick flying into a tree. But the witches of movies, costumes, and lawn ornaments bear little resemblance to real witches, historical or modern. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, October 31st, we learn about witches in our culture, from the women accused of being witches in Salem in the late 1600s to people who practice witchcraft today. Forget the black hat and black cat. Witchcraft today is more about core beliefs and a state of mind. Maine Calling is just ahead.
Maine Calling is made possible by support from Maine Farmland Trust, working with farmers to grow the future of farming and food in Maine. Learn more at mainefarmlandtrust.org/learn. Welch & Forbes, working with clients to manage the full range of events that come with building wealth. From investments to trustee services, more at welchforbes.com. And by Maine Seacoast Mission, delivering health care, education, and support to islands and coastal Downeast communities. Learn more at seacoastmission.org.
I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. Yes, today is Halloween, with its cartoonish images of witches that we see this time of year. And then there is the real history tied to witches in New England. Today we're going to learn what people have believed about witches over the centuries and what modern day witches are like. Joining me for this hour, Emerson Tad Baker. He is a professor of history at Salem State University in Massachusetts, an expert in the Salem witch trials, and he lives here in Maine. And Jamie Rice is deputy director for the Maine Historical Society. We invite you to join the conversation. Are you one of those people so fascinated with the history of witches? Do you have a question for our experts today? Or do you know someone who is a practicing witch? Send an email, a brief email, please, to talk@mainepublic.org. Post a comment on Facebook or Instagram, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. Thank you both for joining us. Emerson, Tad, I'll start with you. It's Halloween today. We talk about witches. It's usually the ones from fairy tales and folklore. But you have studied the real period when women and girls were considered witches during the time of the Salem witch trials. Review that strange period in U.S. history. What was going on that it even occurred to villagers to think of their neighbors this way?
Well, you know, really, witch accusations is really a form of scapegoating then or now. And unfortunately, it's kind of a timeless thing. Every society has its version of witches, people who they want to blame for what's going wrong in their society. And in the early modern period from about 1400 to the American Revolution, over 100,000 people, men and women, though overwhelmingly women, are accused of witchcraft in Europe and her colonies. And what Salem is really a part of that. When things go wrong, you fear that Satan may be in your midst, and then you look for the witch who's ultimately responsible.
Okay. My understanding is what set the Salem case apart, Tad, and I really look forward to reading your book, is that the women and girls were actually acting erratically, and that there was something going on, and there's been some mystery over the years about what it might have been. What do you think?
Well, I call my book A Storm of Witchcraft because I equate it to the perfect storm that took place in Essex County, of course, and destroyed the fishing fleet with great loss of life. It takes a lot of bad things taking place at once to create what was by far America's largest witch hunt. You have factionalism in Salem Village, which, by the way, is present-day Danvers, not Salem. There's your trivia question for the day. And in the colony, political unrest, religious tensions, because witchcraft is really a religious crime. And yes, even other factors like the worst weather of the Little Ice Age and a war that the colony is losing in Maine, of all places. And when these things, sorts of things go bad, people look for solutions and they eventually figure out that Satan is in their midst. And of course, his minions are witches.
All right. Well, Jamie Rice, there are some Maine connections. We think of the Salem witch trials as being something that happened in Massachusetts. And actually, I'm going to back up a little bit and say people refer to it as the Salem witch trials, but that really is not a very, I don't know, it's not a really great phrase, is it? Because they were not witches. They were women and children and girls.
Yes, I mean, I think that there is a, well, a couple of things. They, you know, the witch trials, sort of that witch accusations. And as Emerson mentioned, there is a main connection to what we largely know as the Salem witch trials. But I think when you think about stories of witches in Maine, a lot of it's really tied to folklore or superstition or stories that have just passed down in generations. So when we think about things like the witch's boot or the witch's grave or some of the sort of these stories, a lot of that more is grounded in rumor and tales that have passed down through time.
All right. Well, Tad, tell us about actual people involved in what happened in Salem and their connection to Maine.
So, well, we could spend days. There's over 40 people who are either from Maine or have strong connections to Maine. And in fact, one of the causations in Salem in 1692, it really was a war panic that was taking place because Massachusetts Bay, which and then, yes, owned Maine too, was losing this war really badly against the French and the Native Americans. And you have many people who are refugees from Maine who have come down to Salem, and some of the afflicted girls, the ones who are suffering in 1692 and showing symptoms of possession, are from Saco, are from Berwick, are from Falmouth, what we now call Portland, right? So you have accusers. You have judges who are wealthy Maine landowners who own sawmills that have been destroyed. You have Governor William Phipps, who's governor during the witch trials. And he's, of course, from Woolwich. He's a successful treasure hunter. So all these people being involved is not a coincidence. It's all tied to this fear that's going on that fuels the witch trials outbreak.
Jamie, I recently was reading some quotations about witches. And one of them is from an article in which Pam Grossman, who has a podcast, says, "Show me your witches and I'll show you your feelings about women." Do you think that's true?
I do. I think that, you know, it's outspoken women, women who lived alone, women who didn't behave according to society's expectation, were targeted as part of these accusations. So it is about conformity. It is about expecting people to behave in a certain way, and that you can see that through the accusations that are being made, either by other women, by men, or by the community at large.
Jennifer, and if I could add too, it is, as Jamie suggests, it's really about conformity. People who don't meet expectations, who are somehow strange or different. It's basically forms of scapegoating. And it is mostly women. Throughout time, about three quarters of the people accused are women, but also, you know, the rest of them in Salem and elsewhere are men. Oftentimes though, the men are members of witches, women who have been accused families, because witchcraft was believed to pass in families, or men who would have the temerity, right, to defend women who have been accused. And frankly, it all comes back to those pre-modern notions that we very much bristle at today, that somehow women were inferior or more susceptible to Satan's tricks and wiles. But
and these sort of bizarre tests that people were expected to undertake in order to prove whether or not they weren't a witch, like strength tests or blood tests or sort of these other kind of superstitious activities that would sort of tell whether somebody was a witch or not. So it's a combination of this conformity and this group and superstition kind of coming together.
Of course, today there are people who consider themselves witches. We're going to hear from people later in the program who proudly call themselves a witch. Tad, is there a difference between what we're talking about historically and people who relate to witchcraft today?
Well, absolutely. And it can be very confusing. And frankly, I have to be very careful how I frame this. I usually say, you know, in the 17th century in Salem and elsewhere, we are talking about people who allegedly have sold their souls to Satan to use his evil powers to harm people. And that's entirely different than the modern, neo-pagan naturalistic religions, Wicca and others, which is a wonderful religion that's all about being kind to people and animals and Mother Earth. So oftentimes I'll talk about, you know, witches in 1692 as opposed to neo-pagans today, because it, certainly you do not want to confuse the two at all.
All right. I'm going to read you another quote. This is a writer, Bianca Bosker, wrote in The Atlantic. Accusations of witchcraft spike during times of turmoil. Jamie, do you think that this is true?
I do. I mean, I think you see the prime example, obviously, being the Salem witch trials in 1692. But there's been other cases. There were cases beforehand, for sure, in places like New Hampshire and Connecticut, amongst others, I'm sure. But you can see that. I think, you know, that's the most famous. But this, you can find that pattern as the accusations pop up throughout colonial America, as well as in Europe, in a variety of different places.
Essentially, if something goes wrong and you can't explain it, you look for someone to blame, right? And particularly Wolfgang Berlinger, a European witchcraft historian, who's also an expert on the history of weather, points out that the two biggest factors in his mind is if you have is horribly bad weather, because if you have bad weather and crops fail, people die and starve. And people can stand that, though, if the second factor is in play. If you have a strong government that you know is going to look after you. But if you have really horrible, erratic weather combined with a government that you don't trust has your back, well, you know, frankly, you will all end up with accusations of witch hunts. And I'll just say some things never really seem to change.
Well, and talking about things never changing, I wanted to ask about that. Why the story of the witch trials in Salem, you know, has such a lasting meaning in our society. Most of us read The Scarlet Letter in high school. I just saw a terrific play at Mad Horse Theater called Witch, and it's about the devil, or somebody training to be a devil coming to a town and trying to lure people. And I'm wondering, Jamie, why does this whole idea of witchcraft, of Satan, of women who are different, why does this have such a lasting impression through the centuries? We're talking about 1692.
Well, I think it's the fascination with, you know, I think you can kind of look at it and equate it to sort of a fascination with true crime and kind of understanding or being interested in some things that maybe can't quite be explained in the hysteria. I think there's a variety of different ways to look at it. Maybe you would have a better understanding of why this particular case. I mean, certainly the number of people involved probably elevates it above some other issues. But what about Salem makes it like the queen of all witch trials?
well, that's that, yeah, Jamie. That's one of the reasons I wrote my book. I couldn't understand why. I mean, I hate to say this because the Salem witch trials, on the big picture, are small scale. There were witch hunts in Europe. There was a decade-long outbreak in Cologne, Germany, where 2,000 people died. But, you know, Cologne's a beautiful cathedral city, and I've been there, and it's lovely, but no one mentions witches. So Salem, and I don't mean to lessen the tragedy of Salem, where, you know, we had over 150 people with legal charges, 19 executed, one pressed to death, five died in prison. And one of those who died in prison was my ninth great uncle. So I certainly understand that suffering. But I think there's something fundamentally different about Salem. A couple of things. One is it's the first mass failure of an American government to protect the innocent. And I think it starts that sort of distrust of government, honestly, that deep trend that we all have, regardless of our politics. And I also think, too, is it was such a fall from grace because Salem was the founding city of Massachusetts Bay. It's where John Winthrop allegedly gave the sermon City Upon a Hill, right? This shining utopian example. And the downfall in the lifetime when people would have heard that sermon, people were still alive in 1692, when you have granddaughters accusing mothers and grandmothers of witchcraft. And it's just such a horrible fall, I think, from that Puritan ideal that people refused to forget it. And particularly the victims who petitioned for redress of grievance forever. And in fact, we only had the last convicted witch finally pardoned by the Massachusetts legislature in 2022. So it's been an ongoing saga that it really is America's witch hunt and America's tragedy.
On the line with us now is Frances Denny. She's an editorial photographer and the author of the book Major Arcana, Portraits of Witches in America. Thanks so much for calling in, Frances.
Hi, Jennifer. Thanks for having me.
What prompted you to focus on witches, and how did you go about finding women who consider themselves witches?
Yeah, so I was deep in the research process for my first book, and for that, I was delving pretty deeply into my family's ancestry in New England. And I discovered that one of my, I think it was my 10th great-grandfather, was Chief Justice Samuel Sewall, who, speaking of Salem, was the one of the central judges in the Salem witch trials. But I also discovered that, coincidentally, one of my, I think she was my 8th great-grandmother, I want to say, her name is Mary Bliss Parsons. She, too, she was accused of witchcraft in Northampton, Massachusetts, about 20 years prior to the Salem trials. So I had made this kind of discovery of this strange coincidence of almost like two sides of the same coin, right, on this family tree, and it really stuck with me. So, you know, as artists are kind of wont to do, I tucked it away and for sort of future use, and was reminded of that ancestral link to this word witch when I was reading Stacey Schiff's historical account of the Salem witch trials. And of course, there was my 10th great grandfather, Samuel Sewall, featured prominently. So I really started thinking about this word witch and the power that it has had for, as you were all just saying, you know, centuries, and how it's really kind of traveled through time and acquired, it's been a kind of historical scapegoat. It's become a kind of archetype that has many different faces, but it has sort of acquired this baggage, right? And yet it has this mystery and I would argue power to it, this word witch. And so I began thinking about it and wondering, you know, aren't there people out there who have reclaimed this word or who have kind of, who call themselves witches? And what does that mean? And I was a total outsider to this. So that was the real jumping off moment, the spark maybe for what became this book.
You know, I'm so glad you used that word reclaimed, because I was wondering if that was going on. Tad mentioned that people who call themselves witches today are often thinking about goodness and nature and spirituality. And is there a reclaiming going on and really trying to change the power of the word witch?
I think so. I think it is. It's like taking it does have these negative associations, right, which we've been talking about. And so I think it has been turned into this, and there is something subversive, right, that in doing that, in taking this negative sort of shrouded word and turning it into one that I would argue is really about power. I think that, I mean, it's really hard to generalize. I'm sure we'll get into it. All the people that I photographed over 75 people for this series of portraits. But at the end of the day, and all of them had really disparate practices of witchcraft, but I really think if you boil down the essence of it, it seems to be a kind of reclaiming or cultivation of a kind of inner power or resilience. And maybe it's also for many, like being in tune with yourself and with the earth, for finding alternative systems for processing the world around us. And I think if you look at it that way, yes, there's a subversiveness to it, because there's this sort of almost like cheeky nod to this negative, seemingly, you know, historically negative word. But when you look at it this way, it doesn't actually seem sort of supernatural or scary. It seems like very human, right? This is like a very human quality that many of us have, a kind of searching for meaning in the world.
Frances, one of the things that's interesting is that your witches represent different ethnic groups, different ages, quite a variety of women.
That's right. Yeah, I realized really quickly when I started photographing people that this world of witchcraft was incredibly diverse. And I mean that in so many different ways. And I knew that the project would have to reflect that. So there's a real diversity of faces and body types and ethnicities, but also ages and geographic locations and belief systems. And I think, you know, what surprises people looking at this book is that for a long time, I think, you know, witchcraft practices have been perceived to be a really Anglo-American tradition, but I think that it's just so much bigger and richer than just that. It's what I found was there really is not one way to be a witch, you know, or look like a witch, or act like a witch, or practice like a witch. It's a really kind of individualized identity.
Well, thank you so much for calling in. I know it's a busy day for you. Frances Denny, a photographer and writer, her book is called Major Arcana, Portrait of Witches in America. We're going to take a quick break. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. We're talking about witches and how they've been perceived in the past, who they are today. With me, Jamie Rice, Deputy Director for the Maine Historical Society, and Emerson Tad Baker, a professor at Salem State University with books about witches and the Salem witch trials. Join the conversation. Our email address, talk@mainepublic.org. You can comment on Facebook or Instagram or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. Again, 1-800-399-3566. Joining us now is Nicole Luttrell, who owns Dory Woman Rowing and is a Maine guide. Thanks for calling in, Nicole. I understand you're also a witch. Tell us about that.
Yeah. Hi, Jennifer. Thanks so much for having me on and doing the show. Yes. So I do identify as a witch, and in particular, I identify as a water witch. So I'm actually out here in my traditional style wooden dory sorcière out in Belfast Bay one of my witch.
There we go. I'm sorry, Nicole. You know what? Right at the beginning, we missed the beginning of what you said. So if you could repeat yourself, that'd be great.
Oh, okay, great. Well, I just said I'm really happy to be on the show. Thanks for doing the show and including me. And yes, so my name's Nicole, and I do identify as a witch. And in particular, I really am attuned to the element of water. And in fact, I'm out here in my traditional style wooden dory sorcière, which means witch in French. And I'm out rowing with a witchy companion as well. And we're warming up my boat for the Witch's Row that I host in Belfast Harbor this evening.
So the Witch's Row that you host in Belfast Harbor, do people dress in the like sort of hats and black capes or not so much?
They totally do, Jennifer. They express their witchy self. And so we have witches who row. We have witches who sup, stand up paddleboarding. We have witches who paddle. So we have a nice variety of witches who form a wonderful on-the-water coven here in Belfast.
I love the use of the word coven. And Nicole, you probably heard the conversation up until we came to you. Is this a reclaiming of a word for you? Is this about power? Is this about fun? Tell us what it means to you to be a witch.
Well, it's all those things, Jennifer, and I happen to agree with much of what Frances said. I think it's very much about power and empowerment. It's about authenticity. It's about creativity. It's definitely about fun. It's about attunement with ourselves and the natural world. And, you know, for example, water is such an incredible energetic channel. There's, you know, hard science out there about the impacts of being on or near the water. And I really think that for me, being a witch, which is something I have felt all my life since I was a little girl, is really about transformation.
Mm. And I have to let you before we let you go. You said you felt this way since you were a girl. Do you feel as though you can create spells or make things happen?
I think that, you know, witchcraft, you know, magic can take many different forms. And I think really for me, it's about getting very clear about my intentions and setting intentions. And then, you know, harnessing energy to attract or draw in what feels authentic for you, for me. And, you know, there are many different modalities witches use, which can be the natural world, which can be tarot, astrology, crystals, candles, the moon. I particularly align with the moon in addition to the water, and in fact offer a monthly full moon row out in my boat year round. So, you know, do I have a cauldron and cast spells? I will say no, but I will say that my boat is this, you know, incredible vessel that I love to come out here in and set intentions and see what it brings in.
Well,
just
Nicole,
a little while ago, we hoped to see some seals and we set some intentions and we saw some seals. So that was pretty fun.
Well, thank you much for calling in. Nicole Luttrell owns Dory Woman Rowing. She is hosting a witch's row in Belfast Harbor tonight. We'll go to Moosehead and Rich. Let's see here. My goodness, I'm having a little bit of trouble. Maybe one of our producers can click in. Rich, calling from Moosehead.
Hi, yeah, I can
go
hear
ahead.
You now.
Great.
Yes, yes, I'm a descendant of Elizabeth Jackson Howe, and she was accused as a witch in Salem in 1692 and hung on July 19th. And she was a wife of a blind farmer who ran the farm and spoke out in town meeting, and it was thought that that was why she was persecuted. And the families have always called them innocent blood instead of witches, because that was the term that was used when the family sued the England for wrongful prosecution. And I just wanted to bring up her story because she prayed for the people who were hanging her as they did it. She said she did not worry about her soul, but that she worried about theirs. And I just wanted to bring up that fact that they were called innocent blood. And
I appreciate it. Tad wants to jump in. Go ahead, Tad.
I just want to say that term innocent blood is wonderful, because the families of the victims, including Elizabeth, worked for over the next 50 years after the trials to get what they call this restoration of innocency, right? They were insistent upon this. And Jennifer, to your question earlier, it was that insistence and constantly going to the court and petitioning for relief that led to the witch trials in Salem being remembered as much as they are.
Rich, thanks for your call. An email here from Bruce. Sir William Phipps, who started and ended the Salem witch trials, was born in Woolwich in 1650 and was one of 14 to 26 children, depending on the source. He was knighted, and after he recovered a fortune from a sunken Spanish galleon and paid a tribute to the king. Well, in St. Andrews, Scotland, years ago, we saw a cliff from which it was common to throw witches to see if they would float. So New England wasn't the only place where they were tortured. You had mentioned Sir William Phipps already, Tad, but this reference to what happened in Scotland, that's pretty pretty terrible.
Yeah, and again, and not out of the ordinary, unfortunately. Really, again, like there were about 50,000 people, majority women, who were executed for witchcraft through various horrible means from about 1400 to around the time of the American Revolution. So, you did not want to be accused of being a witch at any point.
An email here from Brian. My sister-in-law did genealogy searches and found that we were directly related to Mr. George Jacob, who was one of the four men who were hanged as witches at the Salem witch trials. 5 years ago, my older brother, who lives in Massachusetts, needed to undergo surgery. He discovered that his surgeon was a direct descendant of one of the four judges who condemned our descendant to death. It did not stop there, as a second physician was seen in consultation who was also a direct descendant of one of the other judges at the trials. Thankfully, his surgery went well and he survived despite what appeared to be overwhelming odds. You guys are everywhere, Tad.
Well, I really think there are literally millions of descendants, and I can't give a talk without having one or two. And if you think about it, in the end, over 150 people accused. You're talking about nine judges and a few dozen people who served in juries. There are over 1,400 people involved in the witch trials, and that was 320 years ago. So you go out 9 or 10 generations, and you got millions and millions of people who are involved. And basically, you know, Jennifer, if you're not, then your husband or the person sitting next to you probably is related to this, because it really is kind of the American tragedy.
We're going to take another quick break. This is Maine Calling. We're talking about witches. Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. talk@mainepublic.org is the email address, or you can find us on social media. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. What does it mean to be a witch, and how does the concept of witches changed over the years? Joining me today, Professor Emerson Baker, who goes by Tad. He's with Salem State University and lives in Maine, and Jamie Rice with the Maine Historical Society. Share your questions or comments by a brief email, talk@mainepublic.org. You can also post on Facebook or Instagram, or of course, call us. 1-800-399-3566. We'll go to Patty, who's calling from Clifton. Hi, Patty. Go ahead.
Hi. It's just another example of men being afraid of women's power, I think, because a lot of times the people who are listed as witches were the healers in the community. They were the ones that had the old knowledge. They could help people who were sick, whereas the clergy could just ask you to pray, and that may or may not work. So I think a lot of times it was fear of the power that these women had.
Fear of power. Jamie.
I would agree. I think that when you look at the ability to heal, when you're looking at maybe homeopathic methods or traditional methods, you also, it kind of comes synonymous with the ability to harm. And if you have the power to heal, you have the ability to harm, and not really fully understanding and being afraid of what people don't understand. And in many ways, the government and religion, especially here in New England, were closely intertwined. So it's not really one or the other. So it kind of comes hand in hand.
Tad, thoughts?
Well, and particularly too, we're talking about things that verge on what we call white magic, because people could also harness powers to heal and help, to find lost objects, to cure people, to tell people's fortunes. But unfortunately, you know, the religious authorities considered that to be invoking Satan's powers as well. So whether you used those powers for good or evil, you still were accused of witchcraft. And of course, we all recognize the difference between this, because we've all watched The Wizard of Oz, where we have, you know, the Wicked Witch of the West, and on cue she's dressed in black, and there's Glinda, the beautiful good witch of the North, who's here to help Dorothy and to help to find her way home, you see? So there's always been this duality, really, to magic.
Patty, are there witches in your family?
Yeah, my daughter is a witch, and I have another daughter that's clairvoyant. And we're from the Salem-Danvers area.
Hmm. When you say she's clairvoyant, what are the kinds of things that she's able to see?
Well, she can see spirits, and spirits talk to her. Like right now we're working on a murder mystery. A woman who said to her, you have to come and find me before the water takes me away. And there's a woman that's been missing for years. And at this point now, that spirit has said, it's too late. I'm gone. There's no proof. But we did have people go, and we did have the police go to investigate it. And they did find some items that belonged to her, but the body just will never be found. But it's more like she sees the spirits around us. She is, my other daughter is white witch. We only in my family believe in doing good spells. You know, if you say someone has evil intent towards you, then you pray for them to, you know, get better. Whatever's wrong with them gets better. That's the kind of thing that my family does.
Well, Patty, thank you so much for calling in. We'll go to Bangor and Ted. Hi, Ted. Go ahead.
Well, thank you. You can hear me, correct?
Yes, yes.
Thank you. Well, I heard the term 10th great-grandfather, and yes, I also had a 10th great-grandfather in Salem, as I guess many of us did. And their name was Buffum, and I'm not sure they had been persecuted as being Quakers and not attending the Puritan, you know, later congregational meetings back in the early 1630s. And they were also, after my branch left, involved with the Underground Railroad. So they seemed to be good do-gooders. But the official Buffum Family History, Volume 1, tells of my 10th great-grandfather being involved with under the cover of darkness, transporting the hanged or crushed witches secretly at night across the river to bury them in consecrated ground. And my understanding is there was quite an undercurrent of support for these people, but, you know, I don't know how willing people were willing to stand up for them in public. So this is what's been passed down to me through this book. And when I heard about the 10th great grandfather, I had to come in, and I think that perhaps it's true that there were many people who thought this whole affair was absurd. And but again, you know, do you stand up against the mob? So
yeah, Ted, thank you so much. And Jamie, these themes of fear, courage, cowardice, we're talking about witch trials, but they are themes throughout our history.
Absolutely. And the conformity is really the piece when you think about, you know, the Quaker faith or Baptist or communities that fell outside of what was the expected norm, you see the accusation. So fear and conformity is a central theme in this story, but unfortunately in the broader Western history.
And just so people realize how diverse early New England was, yes, the Buffums were one of numerous Quaker families in Salem, where 10% of the population was probably Quaker. And in fact, the Buffums lived in a house within sight on Boston Street of the execution site. And yes, that's a family tradition. Then they, and perhaps even some other Quakers in the neighborhood, helped under covers of darkness, helped families recover their loved ones and bring them home for burial. And it is an indication of that groundswell of quiet support for the victims and their families. And it's ironically, no Quakers actually were accused in 1692, even they were very much sort of religious outcasts in Salem. But many people who were related to them or were friends of theirs ended up being accused, I think, sort of as a proxy to them.
Ted, thanks for calling in. Ted, I understand that you just mentioned that some of the Quakers, the Buffums, lived within sight of where the executions took place. I understand that you are sitting in a house right now in York, Maine, with a pretty interesting view as well.
Yeah, we live at Snowshoe Rock. I'm looking out my window out there now. At Snowshoe Rock is where the Native American raid began on York in 1692. And it was that raid that ended up killing or taking captive about 100 people in York, and including the Puritan minister, and just really started the panic that set off the witch trials, because York was this peaceful shire town on the ocean. And there were many people were from the Salem area who had moved up here. And when their families were attacked here, it really made them worry that they, in places like what we think of as Danvers and Salem and on the North Shore, that they weren't safe down there either. But Jennifer, one thing I do really need to stress is, I certainly don't mean to imply anything by the Native American attack. This was in the middle of King William's War, which was a horrible, lethal conflict. There were no innocent people. Women and children were fair game in all of these battles. And for every Native American attack on an English village, there were English raids by the militia that destroyed Native American villages and cornfields, killing Native American women and children. So, but that is to say, I think a lot of this sort of that, the panic of these battles in Maine, these attacks in Maine on Portland, or as it was Falmouth or Berwick or York, we're really triggering events to what happened in the Salem witch trials. So I do love kind of having a piece of the Salem witch trials literally in my front yard.
And Jamie, what Tad is talking about is something that really isn't studied much in school, but such an important part of our history.
It's a really complex history of violence and struggles that were felt from the government down to the local communities. So that fear and uncertainty, again, just feeding into the hysteria or any kind of hysteria of not being, I think, and Tad, you had mentioned something, you know, earlier about sort of, you know, whether the government can support you. And it was not an era where there was a lot of quote unquote protection and support for people. And so really kind of having to look inward for explanations for what was going on in a really uncertain world.
And particularly too, Jamie, you're absolutely right. Particularly in Maine, I think people felt like they'd been abandoned by the government and hung out to dry, and were kind of like the early warning system, right? So remember, people in Maine were not really devout Puritans. They were a very mixed group. And I think Massachusetts Bay kind of felt like, well, let the people in Maine be the early warning system, and that the Native Americans can attack them, and all of us good Puritans down here in Massachusetts proper are safe. So it really was seen very much here as kind of like the people being sold out by the government.
An email from Andrea. Years ago, the interfaith chaplaincy at the University of Southern Maine was the first in the country to have an affiliated associate chaplain from the Wiccan community. She identified as a witch and was co-leader of a nearby coven who served as a gifted spiritual teacher and guide to many of us in the university and wider communities. Interesting. Thank you so much for sending that in, Andrea. Here's an email from R. I am a solitary witch in Western Maine. Can your guest discuss how property disputes influence the Salem witch trials? Both of you are smiling. Jamie, you go first.
Well, I don't know specifically about the Salem witch trials, but there are property disputes. You do see that people arguing over boundaries, whether or not it's who owned what's land or people's livestock coming on to other people's land. But that actually, I think in Tad, in your book, the about the New Hampshire crisis really kind of gets at the crux of that, people making accusations when they want someone else's land or they don't feel that someone else is minding those boundaries, but as a way to settle civil disputes with accusations of witchcraft.
Yeah, the my book, The Devil of Great Island, the subtitle is Witchcraft and Conflict in Early New England, and it focuses all around the sort of neighborly dispute that takes place, where literally there are these two families arguing over literally 2 acres of essentially swampland or marshland in present-day Newcastle, New Hampshire, Great Island. And literally there's a 25 or 30-year legal dispute over this property, and it ends up with the two sides accusing each other. The Quakers, the Waltons, who were Quakers, who run this debauched tavern on Great Island, and they accuse the property owner, their elderly Anglican widowed neighbor, of being a witch. And so she accuses him of being a wizard. And there's it's absolutely true that these tensions between neighbors cause witchcraft accusations. But one thing just to make clear, Jennifer, there's the sort of myth that people accuse their neighbors in 1692 of being witches to get their land. It is true that if you were a felon, your livestock, your clothing could be seized, but not your property. And even the things that were seized, unfortunately, it's like every April 15th, the government got the wealth. There was no finder's fee to the person who accused the witch. But that doesn't mean to say that disputes weren't a problem.
We'll go to Theo, who's calling from Portland. Hi, Theo. Go ahead.
Hi. I just was able to tune in. I wondered if you had been talking about modern witches, because I make a podcast with a witch named Rebecca Allman, and we talk about changing the narrative of witches and magic around stories of powerful women. And Rebecca is a witch who works with powerful people who are trying to tap into their internal knowing. She works with a lot of people in tech and Silicon Valley and Wall Street, and I find it really interesting how people have turned to this kind of magical plane as we all are trying to fumble around and find our way in this year, 2024. And I wonder, if that has been part of your discussion at all, sort of how people are using magic now.
It has been a part of the discussion, Theo, and I'm wondering if you want to expand on that in terms of this idea of magic and spells and modern witchcraft.
Yeah. So on our show, which is called Voices in the River, we talk about how people use, for example, tarot in their lives to help them make decisions, or how they use their intuition. I think intuition is a really big kind of crossover here between the magical world and the more like mainstream intellectual world, right? We hear people talking about, oh, I listen to myself and that's how I know what to do, or I block what I'm thinking and then I don't feel great. And so just this notion of intuition feels really powerful for people. And that feels like it comes from a magical place for a lot of people listening to their internal knowing.
Well, Theo, thanks so much for calling in and telling us about the podcast. An email here from Nancy. People who had Huntington's disease were condemned as being witches. What about other mental illnesses as reasons for execution in the Salem witch trials? And she quotes something from an internet site that says, putting it bluntly, the Puritans were inbred. Their close circle was more than religious and economic. They married within and secluded their gene pool. Huntington's chorea, or Huntington's disease, is common in people with dysfunctional genes, and it goes on. But Tad, is that something that you've uncovered in your research?
So, you know, I just say there is no single explanation for what happened in 1692, why people were afflicted and why they were accusing people. There are numerous medical explanations, psychological. I think a big factor is PTSD. There's a lot of conversion disorder and mass conversion disorder going on. I can't rule out things like Huntington's. I'll tell you what, I can pretty much rule out ergot poisoning. But again, is it possible that one or two people were suffering from these things? Yeah, but there's no, if you look at the symptoms of the afflicted, they're all over the map. And so I think a lot of things contributed to what was going on.
An email from Anne. Caliban and the Witch, Women and the Body, Primitive Accumulation is a 2004 book by Italian-American intellectual Silvia Federici. Responding to both feminist and Marxist traditions, the book offers a critical alternative to Karl Marx's theory of primitive accumulation. Federici argues that the witch hunts served to restructure family relations and the role of women in order to satisfy society's needs during the rise of capitalism. Either of you have thoughts about this?
Well, certainly the witch trials are in an era of emergent merchant capitalism. And a lot of scholars have talked about those tensions, again, where those neighborly disputes become more pointed because they become increasingly over power and money. So that's certainly an element that's at play here, yeah.
John writes in an email, I know a huge part of witchcraft is based on femininity, or at least that's my perception. I think women need their own sacred space. But is there a male equivalent to witchcraft? I feel a little silly Googling how to become a wizard, laugh out loud. Jamie, do you know the answer?
Well, I think that the witches are predominantly associated with women, but there haven't been. Terminology, I can't say other than wizard. I mean, I suspect warlock or some of the other kind of more contemporary name for that. But I think thinking about it says something that the terminology needs to be different depending on the gender, right? Because really you want to think about the concept of what a witch embodies, and that shouldn't matter necessarily whether or not you're, so tuning into nature doesn't necessarily have to be tuning into femininity.
Tad, we've been talking a lot about the Salem witch trials, what's known as the Salem witch trials. Was this the end of it? After this, were people embarrassed by themselves? Did they stop accusing other people of being witches? Did this belief cease?
Well, the witch trials don't end because they don't believe in witches anymore. They end because basically, as Increase Mather says, we can't prove who's a witch and who isn't definitively. So better that 10 witches live than one innocent person die. And the belief persists into the 18th and 19th century. And in fact, in Maine, in the 18th century in Maine, there are a couple of interesting cases related to it. In 1725, Sarah Keene, who lived right around where the traffic circle is on Route 1 in Kittery, won a slander suit when a neighbor accused her of being a witch. Because you see, by that time, if you can't prove I'm a witch, I'm going to sue you for slander. Or this really bizarre case in Kennebunkport, what was in Arundel in 1796, where five people are brought into court for basically trying to kill a person, a poor woman, Elizabeth Smith, who allegedly had afflicted one of them. And the judge chides. This is when George Washington is president. And the judge has to chide them and say, now, you know, she's not a witch, and you people need to smarten up and go home and don't cause any more trouble, because witches aren't real, you see. But those beliefs, they persist, and they have all sorts of folk magic that remains throughout the 18th and 19th century.
Well, we have just about a minute, and Jamie, I'm wondering, as you go into your Halloween afternoon and perhaps see some trick-or-treaters, how do you think about this history of witches and witchcraft in New England? Is this something that's a relic, or is it something that is really representational of a larger theme?
I think it has to be. I mean, the fact that we're having a talk today predominantly about 1692 demonstrates sort of the lasting power of this topic. And I'll actually give a plug for Maine Historical Society next year is doing a show called Notorious Maine Crime in the Public Eye that talks about the media and the media of the day, whatever form that is. And it actually starts with the story of the case study of George Burroughs, who was one of the men executed for witchcraft in Salem. So it's, I think it has a lasting power that's onto itself, and that it says something about its ability to last a good, 400 years in conversation.
Well, thank you both for joining us today. Happy Halloween. Jamie Rice, Deputy Director at the Maine Historical Society, and Emerson Tad Baker, an author, a professor at Salem State University, and a Mainer. Today's sound engineer was Jane Donahue. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Public Radio.